accession number 29076, Reel 2.
It went bounced up pretty fast, and it was all right. But we were all praying for our postings. We didn't want to be messing around, you know, doing nothing. And, of course, the Battle of France was... no, it wasn't. No, that was later. There was this phony war going on over in France. And although the RAF was flying over there, and I think a little bit of combat, but not much, there wasn't an awful lot of feedback from what the RAF were doing over there, as I remember at all. I suppose there must have been some. And all one wanted was to get back onto flying, and eventually, wonderful day, our postings came through, and we were posted to a flying training school, in my case, to Kinloss, which is on the Murray Firth, but, you know, up in the north of Scotland. Remarkable airfield. It has the best, I think, so-called best climate in the whole United Kingdom for flying. We were told there were only 3 days in a year when we couldn't fly up there, apparently. Anyway, that's where we were. Shall I tell you about Kinloss now? Right. The principal thing about Kinloss was we were divided into two sections. One was flying single-engine aircraft, and we trained on Harvards, and the others went on to Oxfords. And they were destined for twin-engine, I think. No, you can't get down. Whoops. You can't have that. That's it. Stay there. We were sort of opposite ends of the airfield there, and we were billeted in Nissen huts at about I forget what it was, how many to the hut, but it was very crowded. And of course, the bigger and stronger chaps amongst us, perhaps got maybe the chaps who got there first got the beds nearest to the stove, a coke stove, you know. I think it was called it was a poisonous thing, because the amount of carbon monoxide that came out of that thing, I can't think, must have been very high. And it was much too cold to open windows and things. I wonder we weren't all asphyxiated, but we weren't. And I suppose partly because we stayed out as late as we could at night, and if we were past the curfew hour, which was about 10 o'clock, I think, when the pubs emptied, in forests. I think the places where we could get in under the wire and it'd crawl into the hut. Anyway, the flying, rather more advanced training, because almost everybody had come from a training, elementary training school, as I had. And we had our training very much in the same way as had been the last 30 hours or so with Hawker Hearts and Hines, but we had Harvard, and which was a pretty nippy little American built with a Pratt & Whitney. It was North American Harvard, that's right, with a Pratt & Whitney engine. Very nippy, really. It was quite high powered, it had one very bad habit, though. If you stalled it, it dipped a wing just like that, and you couldn't stall it too low down, because you could do some nasty damage to the plane and to yourself. So you were taught to be very careful at speeds below the stalling speed. And they'd take you up fairly early on and show you what happened, you see, and you'd get up to a stalling speed of about 80 miles an hour and 70, and woof! Over it would go, and you were in a spin. You were up at least 5,000 feet then, because you wanted time to be able to pull out. Well, you applied under instruction the stick forward and full opposite rudder, you see, and nothing would happen. The Harvard used to go on spinning for two or three turns until you thought, oh, Christ, this is the end. It had a vicious nature, as though to punish us for, or George III, you know, for all the nasty things we'd done in America. It really had a very bad habit. And eventually, it would unwillingly come out of its spin, and you were in a dive, and everything was fine. You see? But you once you'd sort of learnt that, you never got used to the degree of viciousness of the spin, but you had to practice it quite a lot, so you had to get attuned to the situation and not to worry too much when it took a little time to go out. Our cross country there was ridiculous. It was being up on the Murray Firth, there's a huge sheet of water in front of you. Before you, if you went due north, you hit sort of Scotland coming in again, you know, right up to Wick and John O'Groats, you know, right at the top end. But what we did was to turn left and go along to Inverness, all the way along the coast, turn right and follow the coast up to Inverness, where we landed at Wick. Well, just before Wick, it wasn't Wick itself. There was an airfield, and we landed there and got somebody in the control tower to sign our papers, say we had landed there, and refueled and came down again. That was the main cross country. I think on one adventurous occasion we went down to Elgin, which is about 30 miles inland or something like that. But I'm afraid my navigational skills were always virtually nil. One looked for a railway line that meant business and going in the direction you wanted to go. And of course, if we went into a tunnel, you know, got a bit foxed and there was no more railway line for a while. Perhaps I'm exaggerating a bit, but it was a bit like that.
How much emphasis was placed on navigating and route finding?
Very little in the single engine department. Very little. You did learn some elementary navigation at Southampton. It was one of the subjects I ought to have mentioned. You did learn a little bit about navigation, but not much. There was no sort of astro navigation or anything like that. It was just map reading and the astro, I think, was for the bomber boys and the multi-engine chaps. Life went on there until May. Weather got nicer and warmer, and one went through more and more, I suppose, aerobatics and practice things for the future. And the whole flying training school was upended and sent down to Cranfield, which is now the University of the Air, I think it is. It's in Bedfordshire. Not to be confused with Cranwell. Cranfield we were sent to, the whole number 14 Flying Train School, I think it was called. That was it. I always mix up the numbers. Anyway, we went down to Cranfield and we got our wings there. We were awarded our wings because by then we'd sort of had all our tests and you were taken up by the chief flying instructor and so on, and you had to sit various tests and so on, written tests. And same old subjects, I think, pretty well all of them that we'd started down in Southampton. And I can't remember whether we went on with any sort of ground instruction. I suppose we must have done it up at Kinloss. Funny, I don't remember that. Perhaps it was, perhaps it wasn't. We went to Cranfield, got our wings, and waited. And now is the time when Dunkirk was on, and the Battle of France had started and was in full flight. And most of us on single engines were posted to operational training units. But as Dunkirk was just about over, I think Churchill told Dowding, or the other way around, I'm not sure, any fighter squadrons must not expect to be sent to France anymore, but the chaps who were posted to operational training units must go straight to squadrons because they were getting a bit short of pilots, and they were. Anyway, I had been posted to Sutton Bridge, which was not OTU, and when I got there, they said, Rose. Oh, by the way, I just got a commission then. When I left Cranfield, I'd been ordered a commission, which was rather nice, and looked forward to a life of comfort compared with some of the more straight-laced circumstances in which we lived. Anyway, I shouldn't really mention that too much, but the chap at Sutton Bridge said, Pardosaurus, no, sorry, I don't know about... Oh, yes, I think a cable came in this morning saying your posting here has been cancelled and you were to go to a squadron. I'll see if I can find out which one it was. It was something like that, very vague, as everything it was about postings. And so I didn't do any gunnery training or advanced operational training, which was a great pity because the instructors at those places had already had some experience in France and were there to teach us what was needed in real life, real fighter operation, to get in there close behind and don't squirt into the air all over the countryside. You're thinking, things were going to fall out of the sky, because they weren't. And learned some really advanced aerobatics and things that, you really needed to shoot the enemy down. And a lot of the enemy's crafty works and so on. So one didn't know that one was missing all this, frankly, but perhaps one wondered why the first posting had been there, but now it had been cancelled. And I was sent to 602 Squadron, which was at Drem near Edinburgh, City of Glasgow, Auxiliary Squadron. And there my adventures begin, and I suppose you could say my experience of the Battle of Britain more or less started up there, because it was already
Did you...
21st, no, it wasn't. It was somewhere around about the 21st, I think, I joined the squadron.
Did you have any influence over where you were posted?
No, none whatever. Insofar it was going to be a fighter squadron and not to a bomber squadron. And I didn't realise what my luck was in that respect. I think because I got a good sort of standard thing out of flying training school. I suppose I shouldn't crow too much about that. But one was supposed to be sort of respectable material or something. But some of the chaps got posted to bomber squadrons where you were more trundling along and you'd have got to be much braver, I think, and have a much more sort of prolonged set of nerves, if you know what I mean. And with fighters, you were up and down fairly quickly, and whatever you did was fairly in hot blood. Whereas the bomber boys, I mean, really, I have so much admiration for them. So you didn't really have any much influence over where you went to. Certainly not specifically to a particular squadron or anything like that. They were just filling in the holes, I think. And so I went up to 602, and from there, my letters that you've got there start arriving at 602 Squadron. I have got other ones dealing with what I've been talking to you about, but I didn't sort of think they were any particular value at all, and there weren't very many of them. But I have got them in case the museum is interested, which I could show them, to do with training during the earlier parts of the war, But I thought the really interesting, more interesting ones were joining a squadron. Shall I go on talking?
Yes. How were you received?
Extraordinarily well. I had rather expected to be looked down on. Maybe I didn't know what to expect, but they were extraordinarily friendly. I mean, when you consider that 602 is an auxiliary squadron and was very much like a young gentleman's club, I suppose you could say, down in it. And I'm sorry, we're not having that today. And most of them were sons, the chaps on the squadron were sons of fairly comfortably off, either professionals, doctors, solicitors, accountants, heads of commercial undertakings in the city too. I think we'd be rather careful about committing any of this, but still in due course. But they were the nicest possible crowd. They'd been flying together, most of them, for several years. I mean, some of them for, what are we talking about, 1940? I suppose some of them for 6 or 7 years before that, all sorts of types of aircraft, some very sort of things like gladiators and biplanes of one sort or another, and Hawker Hearts and Hinds too. But they'd received their Spitfires in, I think it was December 1939, so they had been flying them for about 6 months when I joined them. They were Spitfire ones. They're rather first off the factory floor type, with a pump undercarriage you selected up, and then you had to push and pull a lever to get the oil to flow around and bring the legs up. And this was new to us because the Harvard had automatic undercarriage, and being American. But actually, that didn't last very long. I mean, when we were sent south, we were on automatic undercarriages by then, so that was all right. So there we were. When I say we, I think there were three or four of us from my flying training school also sent to the same squadron. Two of us had had commissions, and the other two, I think, were sergeant pilots. This sort of left a slight embarrassment on our part, I think, because heaven knows why. The division of sheep from the goats was awful, because they were great friends, and we remained so in the squadron. It was fine, but nevertheless, one felt a slight division. There was bound to be, I suppose. I think even at flying training school, you could see the difference between the officers and the sergeants and so on. There was definitely a step down, not really unpleasantly or anything like that. And on the squadron, I think on the whole, it was, as there were some sergeant pilots there already, there was very much a fairly chummy sort of thing, except, of course, there was an officer's mess and a sergeant's mess. But the officers certainly were extraordinarily friendly, and I was quite taken aback, because I'd rather expected to be looked down on, I think. Well, I suppose probably was looked down on, but not in any way that was made to notice, you know. And so the first few days, there was a magister here, a little two-seater monoplane. That was the sort of running in double harness with the Tiger Moth, really. But we also had a Tiger Moth, I think, but I was taken around the countryside, I think, in a magister. And just show, what was there, the Forth Bridge in Edinburgh, and across on the other side, on the north of the Forth, and the rocks and islands and things out at sea, and generally to get an idea of the lie of the land, and also the bad areas of mud on the airfield to avoid, especially with the Spit, which could turn over fairly easily on its nose if you went into a really boggy bit. Then one was sent to do a little solo flying. I can't remember whether it was a magister or a Tiger Moth. But then came the great day, after about, I think, 8 or 9 days of first solo. And off one went, pretty nervous about it. Here was this very modern aircraft. You've been shown around the cockpit quite often by these old sweats who have been there several years, and given a certain amount of advice about takeoff and landing and so on, but it's never quite the same thing as opening the throttle of a 1,000-horsepower motor and trundling along and finding yourself airborne. And then the first thing was to... Oh, yes, that's right. You throttle back a few revs, and you also selected up, I think that was the first thing, in fact, to select up on the undercarriage and start pumping. And of course, pumping with this hand, your hand on the throttle was doing rather the same thing, and there was for the people on the ground, apparently, it was even more scary that you were doing this as you were taking off, and suddenly the near part of the block of hangars shot past your wing, and you thought, oh, crust, I wonder how much I missed that by. It was probably a little more than you thought, but even so, you hadn't realised you got quite as close as that. And so you went round on your first circuit, and you stayed up for, I think, about 20 minutes or so, running round where you'd been shown the lay of the land and so on. And then the moment came in to do your first landing. You carefully selected down and pumped the thing down until there was a click and the light came on, showing a green light showing OK, light undercarriage is down. And you got yourself into the circuit as best you could and gradually eased the speed back and eased the throttle back, and you tried to lose speed more or less as you've been shown, and come, try and put it on the ground as gently as you could, as near to the close hedge as you could, you know, safely. And that sort of way, you rumble on and you were down. The brakes, I think, were a pedal, weren't they? Yes, on the spit. Through the rudder, there was the pedals for the brakes, and you gradually applied those, not too firmly, because it was a not too dry an airfield, and you came to a standstill. And there it was. But the first time, I think everybody admits, it was a little bit scary. it was a lovely feeling, even to begin with, the feeling of this beautiful aeroplane, which would answer so neatly to the controls, and a lot of power and speed, you know, had everything. So there it was, first solo. But a little side thing, a year later, after we'd been down to Tangier, West Hampton, and through the Battle of Britain, one of the aircraft, towards the end of the time at Tangier, had been shot up. And the pilot got it back in, having to jump because there's a special reason for this, had to bring it back in a very poor condition. And he'd bailed out, I think. No, he can't have done. No, he must. But I think he was wounded. At any rate, he got the aircraft. That's right. He got the aircraft back, but it was sent off to maintenance unit for considerable repair. When they were taking this aircraft to pieces, in the exhaust manifolds, they found were two little sticks of dynamite, and this was not the first bit of sabotage that had been discovered. We don't know anything about that, but it occurred in one of the books we've got. But the reason I mentioned this was the aircraft I'd done my first solo on. And we don't know whether those sticks of dynamite had been placed in by somebody on the ground staff who had perhaps a connection with the communists in Clydeside. You don't know. You can't tell. Nobody. I don't think they ever discovered how this got in. I can't see it getting in down when we were on, you know, right in the sort of thick of things down. I suppose it might have been. Or it might have been somebody who was still part of the a sort of rather nasty organisation who were trying to do their part for the Russians, or, you know, who were in those days not on our side. You know, the time of Dunkirk, the Russians were still, I think they had a treaty with the Germans, but you know, it wasn't long after that that the Germans attacked them, so the communists, I don't think, had much love for us in those days. You know. So RCO didn't find out about this till I think after we left. I think somebody in the CID or the aircraft Air Ministry, sort of brother organisation, had been notified by the people at the maintenance unit who'd disassembled this bit and had found these sticks of dynamite and told me, what's all this about? And probably got the bomber people to come and dispose of it, or the bomb disposal people to come and get rid of it. Where on earth did these come? But they hadn't, fortunately, been ignited. And the whole story seemed to be most extraordinary. And I only mention this because I looked back through my logbook and there was the same aircraft letter as the one I went up in the first, when I did my first solo. So I wonder whether I'd been carrying that around for a month or two. Anyway, I didn't. It didn't go off. So.
It was the idea that they'd be detonated by the heat from the exhaust.
I think that was the idea, that it would almost certainly be detonated, but maybe it got shifted or something and wanted a detonator to set it off. I don't know. I gather a stick of dynamite, I think, was rather hard to ignite, wasn't it? It did need a sudden jerk. I don't think it was really the sort of thing you just set fire to casually. But even so, I'll show you, I can show you the thing in his book, which mentions this episode. So here we are at Drem still, where one began to learn when I was at a service station, and You must tell me when either you'd like another cup of tea, or you know, you want to rest or go home or whatever. Anyway, we're still at Drem, and the things I have mentioned there are mostly recorded in this book, and the only actual enemy action that I saw was at night, where they were still trying to bomb Clydeside, and the Clydeside raids, I don't think would come anywhere. I shouldn't have thought they'd come over Edinburgh Way, but they still used to go for the Fourth Bridge every now and then. And our squadron, we were sent up every now and then because there was a warning of something approaching the north, Accrington and stations in Yorkshire and so on. And we were put up in the air quite a bit, but never actually saw a German by day. But the squadron had had a number of episodes before I arrived there, and famously, and this, if you've got enough tape, I must tell you the story, because I'm not sure whether it's in one of the books or not, but before I arrived, some months before, I think about 6 months before, one of the first raids the Germans put across to try and get the Fourth Bridge, Heinkel came over, and the squadron was under command of a squadron leader, Farquhar. He was a Scot, Harry needn't say, and they got up in time to shoot this Heinkel down. And he couldn't evidently continue his flight. He jettisoned his bombs, I think, in the fourth, and found a lovely large field and put down in it on his belly. And Farquhar, I sent the chaps, I think, who'd been with him back to base, and said, "Well, I know I've expended my ammunition on this thing, but we don't want this chap to set fire to it, and maybe, you know, things are pretty early on, so to speak." He wouldn't have known this, of course, much, but it was very early in the war, and if an aircraft got shot down in this country, I think it was the first one to be shot down in this country, I'd better make sure I get hold of the chaps before they set fire to this thing. A nice big field they've landed on, so I'll go and put down too. So he did, but he failed to notice that, do you know the story? Failed to notice there was a ditch across the middle of the field. And so, in due course, he turned over, landed, was running along, and still doing about 20, 30 miles an hour, turned over in this ditch. And there he was, on his back, up above the ground by about, you see, sufficient to break his neck if he pulled his straps, because there was no way of really dropping yourself gently on the ground if you were upside down in a Spitfire. So the Germans, meanwhile, had climbed out of their aircraft, and having seen this Spit do this curious exercise, which they scratched their heads about, it seemed rather strange to a chap to immolate himself in front of them, they went over and gently eased him out of his aircraft and put him on his feet. Whereupon, I think he was a bit puzzled by all this too. And they were obviously chatting for a while, and Farquhar suddenly noticed a body of men with what looked like pitchforks or something coming over the horizon. You see, this in fact was the Land Army, a local branch of, with all the weapons they could muster. I don't know whether they had actually First World War rifles or something with a round or two at the spires. It's possible, but at any rate, he drew his captor's attention to this crowd of chaps going, he said, "Look, in no way had I better leave you to this lot. You better surrender your Lugers."